Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Okay, folks, thanks for coming along tonight. I think it's our second occasion at the Gallipoli Club, and bear in mind you're welcome to stay around later and partake of the benefits of the club. Tim Fisher makes a welcome return to the Sydney Institute, this on the occasion of the publication of his book, Holy See, Unholy Me, 1,000 Days of Rome, Tales from My Time as Australian Ambassador to the Vatican. So I'll be very brief introducing Mr. Fisher since he's so well known. He, of course, is the former National Party parliamentarian, former National Party leader, former Deputy Prime Minister, and I guess it's true to say that he's one of Australia's most prominent ex-parliamentarians. And his interests are broad and eclectic, and in his new book he combines almost all of his favourite things: politics, food, faith, history, Rome, and of course trains. And tonight Tim Fisher is going to talk to the Sydney Institute on the broad topic, an Australian at the Holy See. Mr. Fisher, you're very welcome. Thank you.
Jesuits educated run the world. There's Jared, Jesuit educated. There's me, Jesuit educated. And I think Tony Abbott and Chris Bine and Joe Hockey and quite a few others at this time. And possibly even the leader of the opposition, Bill Shorten, who went to Xavier College in Melbourne. And the Pope and one or two others.
Don't tell him, Tim.
Can I say greetings to you, Jared, and Anne, is outside there, up the back doing good work, and to the Sydney Institute and to all its members. And as I said before, it is just terrific that Jared set up this to go to speaking venue and forum here in Sydney at a critical time when it was needed, and it kicks on, and it kicks many goals. And my first visit to the Gallipoli Club, I was terrified I'd meet Andrew Petrie in the lift on the way up and I'd be involved in some altercation about the running of this club. But I will steer clear of that and say that I'm just great to be back a while now, great to be speaking at the Sydney Institute. And I bring back from Rome a four-word definition of diplomacy, which you will have no trouble remembering after tonight. What is diplomacy? It is all about protocol. It is all about vitriol. It is all about alcohol. And after a big day, it's all about Panadol. There is the end of my speech. Any questions? Can I say it was a terrific experience? I thank Kevin Rudd, former Prime Minister, for ringing my wife's mobile. I said to him, "How did you get my wife's mobile phone number?" He said, "Don't worry about that." And when I go to Rome, I went to Rome. And the Hendersons came up and saw me in Rome, amongst others. And tonight I speak to you in two segments. Firstly, about the book more generally and colourfully. And then secondly, quite separately, a segment on the Nazi occupation of Rome. Because I figure this is the Institute which will have an interest in this bit of history, the role of Pope Pius XII, the exactitude of what happened as we build towards the 70th anniversary of that horrific roundup of the ghetto of Rome, just near Piazza Argentina and the Tiber. And there's some lessons from that which I'll dwell on, but not at length, and then time for questions. The book, Holy See, Unholy Me, 1,000 Days in Rome, is an attempt to share with you the joy of this posting. It was, on Saturday mornings, downtime. I could write if my family were not there, and on weekends I completed the book in the last busy year, in between, you know, €50 to Malta, €60 to Sarajevo, €70 to see and walk chunks of the Western Front, the Battle of Hamel and so forth. It was just such an opportunity to do that on weekends when you weren't being directed by DFAT, the various conferences and the like. And I was the Australian government representative, the Australian Parliament representative, the Australian people's representative to the nation, city, state of the Holy See. the 44-hectare nation, city, state, itself a member of the United Nations. And that answers the question, well, if you've got one to the Holy See, why haven't you got one to the Archbishop of Canterbury and to Lambeth Palace? That is not a sovereign entity. The Holy See is a recognised sovereign entity, a separate country, an international boundary between the Holy See and St Peter's Square and Italy. And indeed, during the war, the SS walked up and down outside and the Swiss Guards on the inside. And under the Lateran Treaty, the same person cannot be ambassador to Italy and ambassador to the Holy See. It has to be two separate people, two separate addresses. But we clearly shared a lot of admin and lowered the cost for taxpayers, car sharing and the like, to the extent we could, quite reasonably, quite sensibly, in your interests, as both Amanda Vanstone and then later David Ritchie went about their work and as I went about my work on the other side of the Tiber. For example, in Geneva, we have ambassadors to the UN's organisations there. They are not allowed to be ambassadors to Switzerland. That has to be someone else in Bern or someone who comes down from Berlin. Well, up until now, we've had ambassadors come down from Dublin or Michael Tate from The Hague. I was the first Rome resident ambassador because Kevin Rudd wanted to boost our interface with the Holy See, the hub of Rome, and more particularly the Latin American ambassadors, all 30 of them, every single country from Latin America, Guatemala through to Brazil, to Argentina, to Chile, Honduras, no matter how small, no matter how big, all had Rome resident ambassadors to the Holy See. And they intimated they were not particularly convinced of Australia's international gravitas until such time as Australia had a Rome resident ambassador to the Holy See. And so we stepped up to the plate. Amanda Vanstone, great work. She saved one Australian company $18 million through dint of knowledge, representation and contact as a good bilateral ambassador should do, and sorted out a particular problem. I won't name the company. But she also brought her dog Gus to Rome. And her dog Gus took an instant dislike to the Pakistani ambassador, the grand lady Pakistani ambassador to Italy, and proceeded to eat the Pakistani ambassador, or at least take a nick out of the Pakistani ambassador, I hasten to say. Otherwise, Gus has already threatened to sue me once over one chapter I have to tone down with regard to his conduct. Well, Gus, don't worry about him. Gus came, a giant Weimaraner, came back to Australia via a quarantine station for pedigreed dogs in Vienna, Austria, at Amanda's expense. And Gus, Amanda and Tony are now happily residing again in North Adelaide. Amanda was succeeded by David J. Ritchie, whose wife, Janelle Bonner, was my chief of staff as Deputy Prime Minister. And I just mention a really good example of why you pay your taxpayers and why a lean DFAT steps up on the consular front. On the 13th of January, at Friday night, the captain of the Costa Concordia allegedly wanted to wave to his mate on the beach, and he managed to collide with two rocks which had been on every map of the Mediterranean for 500 years. Down went the ship. He hesitated for a period of time. The court case on that continues. We had consular staff moving at midnight that night, within 2 hours, up the coast to Porto Santo Stefano, because we knew that's where the people would drift ashore. And they hung an Australian flag outside a friendly coffee shop that offered their services, became the de facto consular emergency centre, and by Saturday lunchtime, 21 of the 23 Australians had been accounted for. We were missing two Australians. We knew from the computers they were 80-year-old Australians and feared the worst. 32 people lost their lives. We, of course, obtained a manifest about 4 a.m. in the morning from the harbour master at Civitavecchio, as no ship can sail without leaving its manifest. What happened? 4 p.m. in the afternoon, this elderly couple danced into the coffee shop and announced that they'd just had the most exciting day of their lives and they'd gone off and had a long lunch before they decided to report in. Very luckily, 23 of the 23 Australians, we started the issue of their passports thanks to the good work of the Consular General Jenny heading up that team, and DFAT can walk tall and be proud of an example of where consular staff, be they in Nairobi this particular week, or be they on shore off where the Costa Concordia went down, is why you have them and why they do a lot of unsung work of a particularly difficult kind. Some 250 passports are nicked every year in and around St. Peter's Square and around Termini. No violence, but one person will fall over in front of you, you'll bend over to pick them up, and the second person will nick your passport, and we will go through that issuing process. Let me just say, the two key campaigns I was involved with on your behalf, small cog, was the United Nations Security Council campaign. And it was the priority of the government, and the opposition at the time said they are in support, previously campaigned for a seat, but had a debate about the timing. Anyhow, it happened that we topped the poll, 140 votes. I was appointed as an envoy to South Sudan, youngest country in the world, a Christian country, and I was sent to Juba, envoy to, and the president I knew wore black hats, so I arrived with a big black Cobra and gave it to him. 1 hour later, I left his office pretty confident we had the vote of South Sudan for the Australian cause. Eritrea, a bit more difficult, an old Italian colony, and Bhutan, where I've been many times, and my job from DFAT was to add momentum to our campaign also with the Latin Americans. This month, Australia is the chair of the United Nations Security Council, and a roundabout sort of way that probably led to Julie Bishop meeting the President of the United States in the last 48 hours in New York. Fast-moving foreign minister already on the stage in the United Nations General Assembly proceedings. That two-year term will end at the end of next year. It was a lot of work, a lot of commitment, and I think we should, where we've given a handshake for some of the aid projects that obviously flowed from that campaign, we should follow through and honour our word with regard to those mainly education projects. We give about 40 tertiary scholarships to Bhutanese students. 100% of them go home. They come down to Wollongong University, Armidale, Canberra University, ANU. They do their courses and they immediately go home. And later they become secretaries of departments and assistant secretaries. And it's a great investment for which the new government is talking of expanding further with the Colombo plan again. And that would be a step in the right direction. The other campaign was for the Square Kilometre Array radio telescope, where a dozen countries are put in to select one or two sites in the world to penetrate further into space with 100 square kilometres of radio telescope dishes. And we have a great site between Geraldton and Meekatharra in Western Australia. Again, I was employed to engage the Vatican Observatory. It's run by Father Funes, yet another Jesuit, yet another Argentinian, and he became convinced that Australia in the Southern Hemisphere had a great case, and we're going to end up with about half that SKA project and the other half in South Africa. But the issues were galvanising, and the one, food security, people smuggling, religious freedom, interfaith dialogue, Christian, Muslim, Buddhist, the Abrahamic religions. Gradually the Roman Catholic Church has got off its high horse. It now issues a message of respect and congratulations at the end of Ramadan, officially from the Vatican to the Muslim faith, and some progress is being made. The most exciting one, as I put a chapter into the book, was on food security. Very briefly, I don't know or don't care whether you, Chris Roberts, and many others are climate neutrals, climate changers, climate sceptics, or whatever. I believe the climate will be forever changing, for whatever reason. But I do deal in facts, and so did this Vatican conference for 4 days over one long weekend. Examined what was happening in the Himalayan glaciers, most particularly, but also in Europe and the Andes. And the northwest section of the Himalayan glaciers are pretty well neutral. But the central section and the eastern section, which feed the mighty Mekong River, the mighty Ganges River, etc., about 25 years and on the current rate of dilution, will vanish. Why? Because the brown clouds of China and India and 4 decades of frenetic industrialisation hit the Himalayas from north and south. Yes, they block out the sunshine, so that might help the glaciers a bit more, but they put particles into the ice, and the particles in the ice then heat up and do the damage. And so you are going to have millions
who are dependent on those river flows, suddenly, without their annual rice crop, to some extent, or a much reduced rice crop, without the food bowl of the South Asia Delta. I am confident that mankind, womankind, that the people of the region and their governments can effectively respond to that, and to the food security issues, front and centre. But I'm not entering a debate as to why this is happening. It is happening. It is a matter of fact that it's happening with the glaciers. And therefore we have to move to look for varieties of rice and wheat and buckwheat and chickpeas and the like, which are more able to stand the climate chaos on the ground unfolding, most notably in South Asia, parts of Australia and around the world. And I've moved on to a board member, honorary, of the Global Crop Diversity Trust, which has a seed bank in North Norway on the Arctic Circle, where we have 700,000 accessions of wheat and rice and the like to further research this area. A food security centre has now been set up by the Australian government in Canberra. We need light touch from the government. We need massive more research funded by whatever means, and we need the right policies which will be sensible about land usage, because one of the other factors in this is urban creep, especially in India, taking out agricultural lands in the process. Believe it or not, one of the best sources for information is the papal chief scientist, Bishop Marcello Sanchez Sorondo, who I got to know very well, because he says of Australian agriculture, we have it about right. And he studied it. And guess what? He also is an Argentinian. If you want to get on in the Vatican, well, you know the story. Because the book also predicted that Benedict would resign. I put it in to ABC HarperCollins in September last year, thinking Pope Benedict would resign next year. Damnation! He resigned on the 11th of February, 2013. And that night, what happened? The biggest bolt of lightning, YouTube it, hit St. Peter's at 9 p.m. that night, as a direct message from heaven that perhaps he'd done the right thing. It was fireworks from above. It was obvious he was resigning. The Italians could not see it. They said, you're wrong. You haven't studied. You haven't been in Rome long enough. I said, listen to what he's saying. Watch his body language. And why has he twice gone up to the tomb of Pope Celestine V to pray and meditate, the last pope to resign 600 years ago up near L'Aquila? And eventually I got an email from one of these Italians saying, yes, you were right, we were wrong, Pope was not. Conclave held, and we now have the first Jesuit Pope, and some wags would say absolutely the last, the first Argentinian Pope, the first Southern Hemisphere Pope, the first one-lung Pope. He lost a lung as a teenager. And he has stepped up to the mark and is providing, I think, a breath of fresh air and standing up to the Italians that crushed Pope Benedict. As Benedict said, there's filth in the church and there's disaster in the Vatican Bank, but he just could not get his Praetorian Guard to get serious and get it sorted with regard to clergy sex abuse, notwithstanding his best efforts, let alone with regard to the Vatican Bank. I'm confident that the key appointments that Pope Francis has made, as I say in the book to some extent, are pointing the right way. A breath of fresh air is going through, and represented by the fact on day two, Pope Francis went back to his hotel across the Tiber in Rome and paid his bill. Day three, he rang his newsagent boy in Buenos Aires and said, look, I've just got tied up in Rome. You might have read about this. I need to cancel my newspaper order. On day four, he had on speed dial the Jesuit headquarters. He'd been a Jesuit all his life. He rang pronto, said the young Jesuit on the reception. This is Pope Francis. I need to speak to the Father General of the Jesuits. Who did you say? Pope Francis? No Pope ever rings on this line. If you're Pope Francis, I am Napoleon. And hung up. 5 minutes later, Pope Francis rings back again and says, now, Napoleon, I want you to stay calm. But it is Pope Francis, and I do want to speak to the head of the Jesuits. And he duly did. I think his appointment of Pietro Parolin, who was in Rome for the first half of my posting, yes, a Northern Italian, but a very smart Northern Italian of great managerial integrity and general capability, as Secretary of State, therefore Prime Minister of the nation state of the Holy See, is a massive step in the right direction. Parolin will take up that job on the 15th of October,
and the appointment of 8 cardinals to oversee a revamp, 7 of which are non-Italian, a long way from Rome, including His Eminence Cardinal George Pell, again, a step in the right direction. So, ladies and gentlemen, Holy See, Unholy Me, 1,000 Days in Rome. The last chapter, or one of the last chapters, had a bit of fun in it. I mean, grand finale, yeah, you got a bit of confidence, you figure the worst you can do is derail a train and be recalled by Canberra, because that's what I did. I organised a steam train called the Caritas Express, first train from the Pope's platform in years, first steam train this century, first train ever where you could buy a ticket as a member of public, and 100 British drunken steam buffs came down from Britain to ride out from the Pope's platform, this shortest private railway in the world, through the International Arch boundary, across the viaduct, and into the Italian railway system, past the Dome of St. Peter's. And it was a splendid day. It did not derail. We raised €20,000 for earthquake bills, had a lot of fun, helped by the Caritas organisation, Trenitalia, the Italian railway system, and we had this group of 3 meeting with me, and getting it sorted, and we went up to Orvieto. But I knew what would happen at Orvieto. Everyone had too much to drink, and I did not want the responsibility of 100 drunken steam buffs from Britain in the Pope's gardens at sunset when we got back. So we diverted into Termini, Platform 1, and discharged there. Let me now turn to what happened in World War II, which may not be on your radar screen, but we're rapidly approaching the 70th anniversary of the Nazi occupation of Rome, which followed the sacking of Mussolini by the king, and Hitler's fear that suddenly, as the Yanks had already landed down the southern end of the boot, Italy would flip from the Axis side to the Allied side. Remembering in World War I, Italy fought on the side of the Allies, fought a trenchant war against Austria and Germany, especially up in those Dolomites. It was horrific what they went through in World War I. World War II, they wavered initially. Eventually the message came through that Mussolini had decided to side with Hitler after he saw how Hitler had taken Austria and Poland and Czech Slovakia, to which Churchill reputedly said, we had them last time, they're welcome to them this time. So Hitler decided to send divisions down to occupy Rome. That they did in 43. And they sent Kappler as the SS commander. And Kappler said, look, let's not round up the Jews. Let's use them in labour forces, because we know there are 8,000 Jews in Rome, registered, magnificent synagogue building that survived World War II thanks to the footwork of Pope Pius XII. Eichmann sent back the famous chilling cable, which I detail, saying, proceed with the evacuation. And so, on Saturday the 16th of October 1943, the roundup occurred. Now, Rabbi Israel Zolli, man who spoke 11 languages, the rabbi of Rome, had been in dialogue with Pope Pius XII. And there had been a bit of banter, and they said, oh, well, maybe if you give us 4 tons of gold, or X tons of gold, I can't remember the exact figure, we'll back off. And so Zolli went into the Vatican, and they released some gold, and he collected some other gold, and that gold was handed over. It was found after World War II, still sitting in boxes down at Biella Wolonski. It had not even been sent back to Germany. At this stage, Nazis were running out of time. But they weren't running out of time to not proceed with a roundup. Now, Zolli said, and the problem was this. The problem was that the Jewish community of Rome was sharply divided between the fascist-supporting Jewish community, who were very strong Mussolini supporters, and the anti-fascist supporters. This was a big split within the Jewish community. And that split meant there was no real coordination of, let's hide the registration rolls. Let's start evacuating. Let people vanish into the country. Let people go into the monasteries and convents. Zolli was on the side of evacuating, hiding. He said, don't trust these Germans. They are coming, they are here, they will do a roundup. The fascist side of the Jewish civil leadership said, no, this is Rome, this will be different. And everyone knew what was happening by then at Auschwitz, not the least of which is because the Hungarian roundup involving Hugo Löwy, father of Frank Löwy, had come through to the Papal Nuncio in Istanbul, who later became John the 23rd, and had come and relayed back to Rome. So that split meant there was no coordinated action by the Jewish community. And just over 1,000 people were rounded up that dreadful Saturday, imprisoned and then taken to Termini. One lady screamed on the platform, "My husband are on board, let me on board that train." That train departed Termini and travelled with 1,002 Romans on board. It was given a special number, X70469, direct from Rome, very little victualling and resupply, straight into Auschwitz. 15 only survived Auschwitz. The other 7,000 were partially accommodated by monasteries and convents around the Vatican. In fact, so the first fact was there's a split of fascists and anti-fascists within the Jewish community, and that did not augur well for protecting people. The second fact was the Pope Pius XII did give an order to open up the convents and monasteries, as well as the Vatican City itself. A very specific order saying that you were to be welcoming to these people and to hide them. And so the Ursuline convent across the road from my apartment in Nomentana had this huge basement, had 100 Jews living there, but they had the SS at their front gate. So they had to starve themselves because they did not want to tip off the SS that there was too much food coming in for the 50 nuns, when in fact they were feeding 150 for that critical 12 months of Nazi occupation. And I went and visited the archives and the diary notes of the Mother Superior of that convent, and things were touch and go each and every day, because had they been caught, the 50 nuns would have been lined up against the wall and shot dead, as was happening under Kapler's regime. But there's no doubt, Pius XII, and I formally quote the order in the book, issued an order to open up the convents and monasteries and the Vatican and Castel Gandolfo, the summer palace bound now south of Rome. Fact three is very directly the many priests and nuns that did step forward with their convents and monasteries to provide that help. But cat and mouse, it certainly was. And fact four was the cooperation of Zoli with elements of the Vatican to get as many away from Rome as possible, especially in the preceding as the preparations were being made for the roundup and the rumours had got around the place. I am aware that many people criticise Pius XII for not having uttered the word Holocaust. In 1942, in his Christmas message, he made an indirect reference to people being killed for dint and only because of their particular religion or their particular race. It is true, he never uttered the word Holocaust. Equally, it is true that he had to face a circumstance where the Belgian bishops at one stage stepped out and made a direct attack on the Nazis, and within 48 hours, many of those bishops and priests had been rounded up and carted off. It is also in the knowledge that Hitler was preparing to invade the Vatican. Fortunately, those plans were stillborn because the Americans came through just in time. Perhaps one of the most interesting quotes in the book is from a fascist, Roberto Farinacci, who said on the 17th of January 1945, "I cannot believe that our Pope, Pope Pius XII, has fully espoused the Jewish cause to the point of offending the sensibilities of his flock." Interesting comment. And there are other quotes in there. The point I want to leave you with tonight is that if you go right through this chapter on anti-Semitism, on did Pius XII do enough, do too little, too much, I think the judgment should be that both the rabbi of Rome, Israel Zoli, and the bishop of Rome of that period, Pius XII, in very difficult circumstances, saved 7,000 out of 8,000 people. They are the broad, rounded facts. Do they get a tick for that? No way. Since about 1962, it has become the tactics of the New York groupings of Jewish people and others to every time the Vatican mentions promoting Pope Pius XII, beatifying, otherwise heading in the direction of sainthood, is a bitter set avalanche of attacks at close to full power against any recognition of Pius XII. In the very moving Holocaust Museum on the edge of Jerusalem, I was there a couple of years ago going to the Bethlehem University, there's a panel which the wording of which was altered last year. It was so very directly offensive and bitterly attacked Pius XII. There's one panel saluting the priests and nuns at the one level, and then there's this other panel said this Pope did not do enough. They've since altered the wording of that. I just want to argue the case that, all things considered, in the very difficult circumstances, that Pope Pius XII played a role which saved and helped directly contribute to the saving of some 7,000 out of the 8,000 Jews of Rome. And he deserves the credit of that, along with Rabbi Zolli. Problem? Just after the war, Rabbi Zolli, I think very unfortunately, converted to Christianity and was baptised in the chapel of the Gregorian University. Yes, there again, the Jesuits. It is the most powerful university in Rome, arguably. It's like Georgetown University in Washington, Fordham University in New York. You've got Gregorian University in Rome. And he and his wife converted to the Christian faith just after the war and chose a name in salute of Pius XII. But says in his biography, I have done this not because I feel an obligation or appreciation or salutation to Pius XII, although I do. I have done it on the volition of my own beliefs. Problem. The moment he did that, he was completely airbrushed out of history and subject to bitter attacks from the other half of the Jewish faction, the old pro-fascist faction, and so his work as Rabbi of Rome in saving lives has been written out of history and dismissed, and with that, to some extent, so is Pope Pius XII. Sorry to dwell on that, but I just think the privilege of spending 1,000 days in Rome and sitting on this, walking along Barbarella Street, where 30 German soldiers one afternoon were killed in a terrorist bomb in the middle of the occupation. Hitler rang Kappler direct and said, by sunset tomorrow, 10 for 1. And so he rounded up 260 Italians. I'll give Kappler his due. He went and got everyone who was on the death list from civilian courts who had been sentenced to hang, and he used them, but he was 40 short. And I can't even begin to tell you how he got that extra 40. Took them down to the Andriantine Caves, just near one of the catacombs, south of Rome, near the Russian embassy. And always on the National Day of Russia, you'd go down that way and you'd pull up at those caves and dwell for a few moments on that fact that 325 Italians were killed that afternoon by sunset in accordance with Hitler's orders. So Rome, an eternal city. Rome, a magnificent city. Rome with a height restriction which has kept the spirit and core of Rome alive. And I try and capture a bit of that in the book. What a privilege it was to be your representative in Rome for that period, to do the best of my job duty. The boys came up, Harrison loves aeroplanes, and he took on one of the Swiss guards one day, which was a bit awkward. But I got around it. All I had to do was put this Cobra outside the ambassador's car, and the Swiss guards would say, that's a bloody Australian, let him in. So I didn't have to show my passport, it worked a treat. Thank you for listening. Thank you for coming along. The book I'll be happy to sign to individuals as you might wish. And full marks to the Sydney Institute. And our history, we must learn from our history if we are to guide our future in a purposeful way.
Many thanks, Tim Fisher. Jenna Grundy's got some copies of Holy See, Unholy Me, and as our speaker said, he'd be happy to sign them after the event. So we come to questions and discussion. I should say initially thanks to the Gallipoli Club for the use of this facility tonight, and the various services are open at the conclusion of this event. So we finished the top, no later than the top of the hour. Thanks for an expansive view of your time in Rome and beyond. Just going back to where you concluded, you're looking at the time of the Nazi German occupation and the consequences for the Roman Jews, rather, I suppose, than the Italian Jews. And you mentioned the year of 62 or 63, but I mean, as you well know, the criticism of Pius XII wasn't led by Jews in New York, it was led by the communists in Eastern Europe around the time of that play, what was it called, the Pontiff, I think, by the East German playwright. And so much of that criticism comes from that period, and others took it up, but that's when it started. Tell us then, you've spoken a bit about the relationship between the Vatican and Nazi Germany. What's the legacy now of John Paul II and the tension that existed towards, not always with the Vatican, but towards his time, at the time of Pius XII and at the time of John Paul II, towards the communist regimes around the time of the Cold War? This is the sort of a legacy you came after.
That's why I mentioned it to you, because of we now know the KGB, in fact, helped bring some of this forward at the time. Tracking very through, Pius XII was replaced by Paul VI, amongst other things. What did he do? He opened the Bethlehem University, the Vatican Bethlehem University on the West Bank, first university on the West Bank, 1,000 Christians, 2,000 Muslims attend that university. It's a brilliant bit of sunshine in a very troubled part of the world. Followed by John Paul I for a month, and it's all been written about, you can read all the books about that. And then came John Paul II, the third longest papacy, 78 until 2005. A great statesman. He not only helped, as Hillary Clinton says, you can thank Margaret Thatcher, Ronald Reagan, the fact Gorbachev blinked, but you must also thank the role Pope John Paul II played in Poland and in helping to bring down the Berlin Wall. And he did, because he saw that there was a weakness in communism which was beginning to gather steam, and he backed solidarity, he backed it financially, he backed it spiritually, he gave it spine in the out years before it took off under Lech Walesa, who, by the way, in the last 24 hours has proposed that Poland merge with Germany. There's another subject for another occasion. You can have the two ambassadors up here, Jared. It'll be a very interesting evening, I can assure you. So John Paul II also, for example, stopped the war between Argentina and Chile over boundaries down the Andes, because he came up with an independent cartologist commission and made 900 adjustments to those boundaries, and both sides accepted that. On the broader front, I think he and Reagan sensed the time was up for the Russian form of communism, for the USSR in particular, and they sensed it. They stayed strong and they turned the tide and made a difference, as helped along by Margaret Thatcher, who then went on to bitterly oppose German unification, I might add. The Vatican has no divisions. The famous question, how many divisions does the Vatican have, as Darwin asked, they have none. But they have smart, soft power. The Cluster Bombs Convention kicked forward during the period of Pope Benedict, because of certain actions he took, some of which I speak of in the book. The other thing is, John Paul II did not differentiate from, did not deviate from absolute opposition to the fundamental tenets of communism. And it was a strength of no compromise, and the leadership he gave until the last couple of years of his life that re-altered the balance. And the rest is history. So I think the Vatican, to answer your question, it played a critical role through critical papacies, most notably John Paul II. Benedict was less geopolitically motivated, less strategically motivated, but I will pick you up on one thing, or I'll argue with you on one thing. Once that play had come out, no doubt that there was and is and continues to be a continued push against Pius XII, whenever there's talk of promotion of him. The Israeli ambassador to the Vatican said, I think it's time we acknowledged the good work of Pius XII during the Nazi occupation in helping to rescue Jews. Within 24 hours, he had to withdraw that statement. So great was the wind-up of pressure against him. In an excruciating way, he had to step back from that statement. So there are those who use it tactically, there are those who use the truth or the interpretation of the truth for various reasons. Why is this important? Well, 70th anniversary. Why is this really important? Because we must never forget the Holocaust and all the aspects of the Holocaust. And unless you were alive at that particular time, it's even hard to begin to think of the agonies that that perpetrated on so many people.
Jim, just stay here. Yeah, just stay here. Yeah. Right.
Any other questions?
Yeah, I'll run this.
Yeah,
okay.
Francis seems to be an agent of change. Do you agree with that? And secondly, if Benedict failed and resigned and with respect to his ability to achieve reform, what chance has Francis got?
Well, I think you summed up Benedict's frustrations, and he took the big step. And he was so frustrated with his underlings, most notably, arguably, the Italian component of it, on two things. The clergy sex abuse set of issues, and the Vatican Bank. It still hasn't qualified under the Basel Accords. It's still a lep-up. They had to shut down the one ATM they were operating for a period of time, partly because it was in Latin. It's the only ATM in the world in Latin. Now, what chance, Francis? Massive chance. He actually is fluent in Italian. He stood up there on that balcony and said, "Buona sera." And a whole new signal that this is going to be different from moment one on that balcony after his introduction by Cardinal Turan. Has he got the stamina, the health? I hope so. Is he going to stick it out and do things like live in Santa Marta, the hotel in the gardens of the Vatican, and not up in the Papal Palace? It would appear so. He's been there now 6-7 months, and people are getting used to the fact he walks into lunch. Everyone stands up. He said, "Please continue," and goes to a seat in the central table. I'm told, come breakfast each day there, half the clergy make a point of having a breakfast an hour early and getting the hell out of the place before the Pope appears, and the other half might hover around the Pope. Francis, I think, has every chance, and the reason I'm confident, and I'm speaking not as an ex-ambassador, I'm speaking as a citizen that's looked at it and had the privilege of looking at it in Rome. The reason I'm confident is the nature of the appointments he's already made in the first nigh on 6 months.
There's a question there. Yeah.
Thanks very much. What is there anything, having been in the Vatican for a couple of years, that you have learned about leadership and government and influence that you think Australia... Australian governments could emulate?
Is there anything you've picked up in the Vatican you think Australian governments might emulate?
I think we need to engage for the long haul internationally and remind our domestic constituency that we can't afford to be insular in a 24 million people OECD country that has to be a trading nation with its products to the world, relies on international tourism inbound and the like, and therefore relationships are for the long haul, be it Australia and Indonesia, Australia, Papua New Guinea, Australia and New Zealand, or indeed be it to the States, United States, as well as to Europe. So I perhaps would just take this chance this night to reflect on your question and answer it by saying we are, as we face our grand final weekend and all, we're entitled to be very pro-AFL and rugby league and so forth. But more generally, though, and partly through the work of the Lowy Institute, the Sydney Institute and others, we need to take to the public square international affairs. And many organisations are getting better at doing that, and we need to continue to do that and build a mantra that international relations are best based on the long haul and best based on bipartisan elements, so they continue notwithstanding our right to change our government from time to time. I might add, I'm also a defender of taking religion to the public square and standing up to the secular extremism, which dominates elements of the media and the like, and we're entitled to argue our corner, or what I would say is the corner I prefer to argue, and frequently.
So right down the back, and then Robin, yeah.
We've had a lot of Italian immigrants to Australia, but we've been an Anglo country. But in your time in the Vatican, Australia left a little bit of itself in Rome. There's the hotel, there's Australia's museum, or whatever it is in the Vatican. Tell us a little bit about how we've become much more part of
the question about the Australian presence in the Vatican.
From your Hoover, which I remember being...
The Australian presence in the Vatican in recent times.
There's an ethnological section of the Vatican Museum. There's the map section, there's the archives, there's everything. But there's this ethnological section. You know, in 1920, the Pope wrote to the Bishop of Perth and said, can you send me up some artefacts from the Kimberleys? And eventually, boxloads of stuff... took a minute, poles from the Tiwi Islands, the funeral poles, the colourful funeral poles, shells, everything. All right, and of course they packed them away brilliantly in the basement, and I had this rumour that this stuff was there. And I engaged the deputy director of the Vatican Museum, and we managed to get them out and put on display for the canonisation of Mary MacKillop. And it was, as you say, and the rituals of life, and a part of that is now permanently on exhibition in the Vatican Museum. So the millions of tourists that flow through that museum get a taste of Australia from this collection. I must admit, a superb collection of artefacts from the indigenous peoples of the Tiwi Islands and Kalumburoo Mission in the Kimberleys, an old, long-standing, beautiful mission just north of Broome. So that I helped along a bit, and I saw that as part of my role, but it's good for Australia. And my successor, John McCarthy QC, is also continuing... support, but you didn't have Domus Australia is a private project of four dioceses: Sydney, Melbourne, Perth, and Lismore. It's a conversion of a Marist monastery to a bed and breakfast. Any person of any denomination could stay there. It's like a hotel, 10 minutes walking distance of Termini. His Eminence Cardinal Pell insisted on large showers so you can actually turn around and not break your elbows a la Europe. Good breakfasts, really good bacon and eggs, and the front page of the Australian newspaper, should it be your wish, on the table as well. I commend you, look up their website, great place to stay. But I don't claim any credit for Domus, but it's a terrific place, and I mentioned it in the book. The last thing I was going to say, though, is what do you do if you're an ambassador with a very small budget and you've got 8,000 Australians streaming towards Rome? You remember that Mary MacKillop opened her first school at Panola in South Australia in 1866, adjoining the Coonawarra wine region. And you write to 22 winemakers of the Coonawarra and suggest they might like to donate a dozen each to the embassy, and we'll give it proper billing and everything and all the function. They donated several dozen each. I wasn't even able to drink the last of it before I came up. My successor has it. And word got around Rome, it was so damn good, the Zima Estates, Shiraz and others, Di Giorgio wines, that occasionally one senior would come up and say, when is your next diplomatic working dinner? Is there any of that Coonawarra left? So you use different methods to promote Australia, as is your remit, to boost the profile of Australia. It's an investment by taxpayers to have Amanda Vanstone, David Ritchie on one side of the table, me on the other, John McCarthy. And I think indirectly it pays off on issues which time does not allow for me to dwell on, and some I can't even speak of, pays off in very practical ways for Cause Australia.
Robin.
Oh, thank you very much. I was wondering if you could comment on the relationship between the Vatican and China. As I understand it, there's been a certain cordon relating to China and appointing bishops not approved by Rome, or has been in the past.
We nearly had
a relationship, just for the podcast, the relationship of the Vatican and China. Yeah.
We nearly had a synthesis of the lists of bishops, where both the Vatican, for a brief period of time, and the government elements of China were in agreement. But then it fell away again in the last 2 years. Paro Lin, the new Secretary of State, Prime Minister, is a former Deputy Foreign Minister of the Vatican. And one of his last trips in that role was to China, but more particularly to Vietnam, and beavering away with setting up dialogue and making real progress. I mean, Vietnam has a constitution which says You have a right to practice your religion, and you have a right to believe in religion, and you have a right not to believe in religion. That's at that level. Get down to the street level, and the local party secretary wants a bit more land off a church school to improve something that he thinks important. They just send in the thugs and bash up the parish priest till he signs over the land. So there's a very different circumstance at the street level, both in China and in Vietnam. Now, I think it will be step by step. It will be very slow. There has been a slight breakthrough on Vietnam and an appointment now of a partial first step towards diplomatic recognition. On China, you know, there's something happening. Bo Xi Lai's case in point. Watch this space to see where the new leadership take China. But there are thousands of practicing Christians in China, some Catholic, some Protestant. It is a pretty fragile existence. It's in the interests of Beijing to actually get it sorted. They could, if they wanted to, if they were motivated to. We'll have to wait and see. All I would say is, at the moment, the Vatican represents formerly Taipei, Taiwan, but they would switch that to mainland China if they got full-scale diplomatic recognition and resolution of some of these bishop appointment problems. Parolin's the one person that might be able to finesse this area. He has the capacity to do so. I think it's beyond Pope Francis's remit, steeped in Latin America, as is Pope Francis from Argentina. One last question.
Ellen.
Pope Benedict has been under fire for this alleged inaction in regard to the sexual abuse issue, but it's occurred to me that the real culprit is his predecessor, Pope John Paul II.
Right, there's a question about Pope Benedict's alleged inaction on child sex abuse, but the suggestion is that the real culprit is Pope John Paul II.
Well, there was some very colourful characters that raised a lot of money for the Vatican that seemed to get a dream run. Eventually they were defrocked, but I deal with that in the book. I'm not in a position to say that John Paul II was other than determined, like Benedict, to eliminate clergy sex abuse and filth in the church. But I am convinced that there are elements of the status quo in the Curia that say things like, oh, you Anglos, this is all your problem. We Italians just don't have this problem of clergy sex abuse. Quote, unquote. And that enraged me as I produced a clipping of a court case involving a parish priest on the outskirts of Rome who had been charged and found guilty of child sex abuse. Look, I think on statesmanship, on Berlin Wall, on Argentina, Chile, on 101 things, John Paul II put spine into the world at a very difficult stage of our post-World War II history. That one or two things may not have been closely administered from on high was certainly the case in his last 3-4 years when he had that lingering death. And that was another reason why I thought Benedict would do exactly the opposite, because Benedict often said there can only be one Pope John Paul II, and in salute of him, I am going to resign rather than try and repeat the long lingering death, which was, you know, think of BHP Billiton, think of AACo, think of companies allowing their CEOs and chairmen to die in office. It's not the best way to run the oldest and a very large organisation in the world that's been around now for nigh on 2,000 years.
Question here. Yeah.
Just a quick question. After you mentioned that Pope Francis has an Italian, and that appears to be such a helping for him. Why does DFAT regularly have ambassadors who are very good at their languages, at different languages, but they send them to countries that are not that they're not fluent in the language?
And I opposed. Alexander Dowd and I had joint signing rights, and I oppose sending this particular person to a Latin American country, a square peg in a round hole, and he doesn't speak the language. And we bounced around on that, and eventually went, and history records that 12 months later he was recalled. I won't use names. It's not wise to not turn up at the airport when your foreign minister arrives in country. Not his fault. And it's not wise to leave, allegedly, your foreign minister standing in the gutter outside the front of a presidential palace after an evening banquet for a misunderstanding if you're the local ambassador, allegedly.
But that wasn't because he didn't speak Spanish. I mean, that was...
You make a point, Jared. So, should they have language capability? Yes and yes. Amanda was fluent in Italian. David Ritchie went off for 9 months to do Italian. Basically, DFAT is now much more orientated to the mantra which you extol, and your mantra is correct. The amazing thing is, though, some of these cardinals switch between 11 languages. Cardinal Oscar Rodriguez, the head of Caritas, now the chair of this group of 8 cardinals, nothing for him to switch between 7 different languages.
So when you're at the Vatican, what was your Latin like?
I wish. The letter of resignation by the Pope was read in Latin, and only a handful in that room knew it was coming. But no, it's hard to believe that 40 years ago Vatican Council II was conducted in Latin. They could never do that again. But people just have not got that proficiency. But DFAT, to be fair, I think, within the budget restraints, are trying to send people fluent in the language to the posts of those countries.
Final question, Craig Shapiro.
You were talking about budget and DFAT. There's been commentary that, and you highlighted how important it is to connect with South America by having an ambassador in the Holy See. There's been a lot of commentary about the fact that the budget's just not great enough for us to connect globally. Given the importance of that, what are your views on what the government should be doing to expand the budget?
Well, the network is about 100 different locations around the world, and I think some places we tighten up, on other places we expand. We close Copenhagen, we've reopened Copenhagen, and by the way, we won't be closing Copenhagen while ever Princess Mary's around. You've got to think these things through. So there are different reasons why you have more embassies, some with only a diplomatic staff of 2, as was my case, the deputy and myself. There are other places where you just have an Austrade office. I know that it might sound like self-feeding, but in a sense, I think DFAT's role is going to be greater, and I think it's going to be enhanced by rolling AusAid back in, to be honest, and some of the backroom stuff can be made a bit more efficient. Language training is one of those. So I leave you with a message that let's all make the effort to try and break down the insularity of Australia, which continues in this, the second decade of the 21st century, even though there are X number of people flying in and out of this country every 24 hours and the like. But we need to continue to work away at that and take to the public square why it is important that we have a firm basis for our relations, most notably with our Asian neighbours, but more broadly with Africa, with Europe, with the Middle East. Sits astride so many of our connections and routes, trade routes, with Latin America, with the North Americas, and the like. The book, Holy See, Unholy Me, 1,000 Days in Rome, I commend it to you.
So, Kim Fisher, for what, as usual, is an informative and entertaining address. Thanks for coming along tonight. All the best with the success of Holy See, Unholy Me, and have a great train trip in South Africa. And we'll see you back with the next book, perhaps on trains or boats or planes or
Monash.
Monash.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.